Hey, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, at long last, after many false starts and mistakes on my part, I'm talking with Max Moritz about fire. Max is a state, national, world expert on the interactions among fire, landscapes, humans, and climate. And we get into all of that, but we kind of kick it off with a gripping discussion of Max's recent experiences with the fires very, very close to his house. Well, we'll come to that real soon. Wanted to make the additional point that Max and I talk quite a lot about the use of models for stimulating climate and fire interactions. And, you know, the models for the future either don't or don't do a very good job of stimulating winds, which of course are a huge factor for fire danger. And Max made the point to me after the interview via email that what this means is that the models are going to have to use some kind of a downscaling technique, like an offline downscaling technique, to get the winds at the proper resolution, probably combined with using a finer resolution model like WRF to actually stimulate those winds. So that's just like a brief addendum to what's coming in the interview. Otherwise, it's been super fun over the past couple of years to see the really unexpected ways that the podcast has been, you know, beneficial for me. I did it because I thought it'd be fun and maybe interesting for you, but there's been a lot of professional benefits to me. So for example, I'm kind of in crunch time on a few papers, and I got back one paper to the reviewers and I said, look, can you please do this as quickly as possible? You know, asking very politely, of course. And one reviewer returned it in one day and said, dear Michael, done. The revised paper is very good. Your podcasts were a factor in motivating me to get the re-review done quickly. Not joking. Now, instead of writing me reminder emails, you can put the time into the next forecast. All the best. Yep, so that was amazing and unexpected, and I'm doing that exactly right now. Also had a really nice email from Lauren Vargo, who I met a little while ago. It says, hi, Michael. My name is Lauren Vargo. We met at the IGS meeting in Wellington. That was about cryospheric stuff. I'm a PhD student at Victoria University of Wellington, working with Trevor Chin's end of summer snow line photos, which, as an aside, again, is an amazing project. I wanted to let you know that I really enjoy your podcast. It's great listening to scientists talk about their work. Also, as a PhD student, it's really nice to hear about the paths that more established scientists have taken to get where they are, and to hear that those paths are not always exclusively filled with success. Thanks to you and all the scientists you chatted with. Well, that's definitely the case. I mean, the pathways people have taken are just so unbelievably Byzantine, and today is no exception, with Max having almost gone into, shockingly, like a career in finance slash consulting, business consulting. Glad we got him back from that. But yeah, that really is a great email to have. And that's part of what we're trying to do here, is to humanize the climate science process and make the point that, you know, these are just people with their own lives doing the best they can and doing amazing science along the way. In other news, I'm going to be in London. And part of that visit will be to visit Imperial College London, to the Center for Environmental Policy, hosted by Niall McDowell. And I'll be giving a talk to which you are welcome to come, 12:30 on this Thursday, March 8th, in the CEP seminar room, which is 16 to 18 Weeks Hall, Prince's Garden. So that'll be the day after this podcast is posted. I'm also going to be meeting with a pretty big group of people from the reinsurance and finance industry who are interested in climate resilience. Otherwise, the trip I've been talking about to Berlin is a go. We will be in Berlin from June 25th through August 14th, and hopefully doing quite a lot of visits to various universities and institutes around Germany, particularly up north. And before that, I'm hoping to be at the SCAR meeting, the 60th anniversary in Davos, from about June 19th through the 23rd, I believe, which is right after my father's 80th birthday in DC. Happy birthday in advance, Dad. All right, so with that, why don't we get on to it? Me talking with Max Moritz about climate, fire, land use, and human society. But first, kicking it off with, for me, like this gripping discussion of Max and his family's recent experiences with the fires down around Santa Barbara. Actually, actually get your official title. Are you a full professor at UCSB, or how should I say?
No. So actually, I have an interesting job title. So I am part of the UC system, which is Office of the President. There's the Ag and Natural Resources Division, mm-hmm. Agriculture and Natural Resources Division. This is the part of the UC that links back to the old land grant mission. Mm. Yeah, and so it only actually exists on three campuses. It's on Davis, Berkeley, and Riverside. Outside of the campus system, there are academics in every county.
So
there's county-based cooperative extension advisors that might work on pests or pathogens or a specific crop or commodity. And then the 4-H and the Master Gardener Program, all of this is under the UC system. This is all part of the ANR wing of the University of California. And so on the campuses, there are faculty and cooperative extension specialists. So I'm actually the statewide fire specialist within cooperative extension.
Okay.
And I spent the first decade, a little longer, of my career on the Berkeley campus as part of a department there. And then after I transferred off the Berkeley campus, I was kind of moved over, and now I'm housed at the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management on the UCSB campus, where I'm an adjunct professor there.
All right. Well, that was certainly the most interesting job description I think I've ever heard. Thank you for that.
Or convoluted. Yeah.
So, I mean, we've been trying to get together to do this podcast for, like 3 months, something like that. I can't even remember how long it's been. Most recently, I was off by one entire month about when we were going to talk. And then, before that, you were dealing with your own issues with the fires, evacuating your family from the fires around UCSB, and then yourself leaving. But before that, we had left the Bay Area because of the fires we had here. And now, I mean, at least up here, it's just bucketing rain. There's a blizzard in the Sierras. We had hail at our house this morning. So it seems like the perfect time to talk about fire. I go, what's it down there? What's it like down there for you right now? Are you also in a big rainstorm?
Well, we had a minor, it depends on how you define it. We finally had some rain again, but actually thousands of people were evacuated last night.
Oh, for mudslides or?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Because of the debris. So after the Thomas Fire, which is what you were referring to, where we evacuated, after that, I think it was before it was even out in early January, there were some heavy, heavy rains. Really amazing rainfall rates that caused these debris flows in Montecito, very close to Santa Barbara. And a lot of people died, hundreds of homes gone, and many more damaged. And again, last night, they were forecasting potentially heavy rains. And so they were we weren't sure what we were going to wake up to again here just this morning.
But did you guys evacuate, or were you under evacuation warning?
No, we were close, but not. We weren't even under evacuation warning, because where we live in Santa Barbara, the hills immediately upslope of us actually didn't burn in this particular fire.
I see.
Yeah. Anyway, so it in keeping or along the lines of what we were talking about, trying to connect, it has been an incredibly tumultuous couple of months.
Yeah, my gosh.
And really, people around here are still kind of walking around in a little bit of a daze. You could walk up to anybody in a grocery store and, you know, just say, are you okay?
How are you doing?
And be like, people no. And people are still really off balance.
I feel like with the debris flows, I mean, that must have been on some levels even more terrifying, because they're more rare than the fires themselves, but this possibility of having, I don't know, 10 meters of mud flowing through and destroying your house and burying you alive is just as an existential threat. It's just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think there's also the sort of whiplash between, you know, the end of the Thomas Fire, which I think a lot of people felt pretty lucky, pretty tired after all of the long-term evacuation kind of warning, but also pretty lucky that God, despite it being the largest fire in recent recorded history, you know, the losses weren't so bad. They weren't nearly as bad as what you guys experienced up north.
Right, there are a lot more fatalities up here.
A lot more homes lost and a lot more fatalities. So people were feeling kind of like, oh, hey, wow, we got out of it. You know, we made it through. And then you know, to be hit with the debris flows and all those additional losses and deaths was a big shock, big jolt.
And you know, at one point we were emailing and you were mentioning that you had the possibility of a lot of toxic ash in your backyard. What happened with that?
Yeah, so apparently there were reports that the ash was containing a lot of fallout from burned plastic.
Yeah, right.
You know, pressure treated wood, you know, that contains all kinds of stuff in it it's not good for microbes, so it's not good for you. We saw lots of people wearing masks everywhere. Mm-hmm. When it was really smoky, people were driving around with masks on in the grocery stores. Afterwards, we got public health warnings about not using brooms, not using leaf blowers, and that it was a real issue. I think once we cleaned up what we could and we got a little bit of rain on top mm-hmm. of it, you know, having it airborne was less of an issue. I don't know what it means for, you know, for soils and stuff like that. I think it was fairly low concentrations, but still not something you wanted to be breathing.
I mean, you were a lot closer to it than we were, but I mean, I was down at a meeting in Scripps when the fires hit up here, and my wife, and we have a 6-year-old son, and I think because of that and the air quality, she was pretty freaked out, and justifiably so. I mean, we just bailed, but I think for you, it was a lot worse. How did you decide, or how did your family decide what to do in terms of leaving? I think they went to Arizona, right?
Part of it was luck. We were actually out of town. We were out of town also when it really started taking off, and we were visiting some relatives on the other side of the country, and we realized on our way back that we probably shouldn't go home to Santa Barbara yet because of all the news we were getting. And I actually talked to a couple friends that had kids, and they said, if you don't have to come back, I would work remotely. I wouldn't do it right now. I was also getting word from the kennel that was watching our dog that I needed to come get the dog. And I also was conscious of the fact that we really hadn't buttoned up the house the way I probably would have if I knew we were going to evacuate, and we didn't have our stuff. So I ended up coming back to Santa Barbara for a week and going through this slow motion evacuation process because mm-hmm. we never really got the trigger to evacuate until about a week after I had been home. So I went through this long, slow process of trying to figure out what to take. And, you know, professionally I study fire, right? So I talk about this. I've had friends that have evacuated. This is the first time I have ever evacuated, you know, in studying fire for 20 years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was really, it was traumatic. It was bizarre and surreal. And I think part of it was this overlay that it is my professional area of study, but mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm. also, you know, I was there by myself for a long time, taking this picture off the wall and not that one and wondering what that actually meant, you know.
Yeah, about, definitely.
You know.
I don't love my dog. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you take and what you don't? And anyway, it was actually very difficult. And then when it finally really got bad, I was also halfway under the impression that it was going to blow over. We were going to get it under control, and I wasn't going to have to evacuate. I was just going to drive out to Arizona, pick him up, and come back home. And then we were going to finish putting up the lights and get the tree. And this was the year where we didn't do that. We didn't have cards. We didn't get the lights up. We didn't have a tree. On the day I left, it was, again, surreal, smoky, freeways clogged, and everybody driving in their cars with masks on. It was very, it was just very bizarre. The whole time I thought we were coming back. That was the other problem. The whole time I thought, well, okay, I'm evacuating, but yeah, we'll be back in a couple days. And nope, I was gone. We lived out of a suitcase for 3 weeks, basically.
When you were going through that process, you're partially in the business of advising people and municipalities about how to deal with fires. Did you ever find yourself doing things that you're like, this is not what I would advise people to do because of the emotions involved?
Interesting. I may have, but I was trying to do the things that I was trying to practice what I'd preached.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to, I know enough about it that, you know, I know you have to go out and you should probably rake a scratch line around your structure, which is just, okay, you know, creating an area where there really isn't any litter or leaves or anything, you know, a couple feet away from the home, cleaning out from under a deck, moving that wooden hamper and that play structure away from the home. Mm-hmm. Getting under the roof and cleaning out the gutters and plugging them with a sandbag and filling them with water, you know, so that if embers hit your roof,
right, yeah,
they, you know, so I went through all that. It took a long time. I went through all those steps that maybe I know too much, you know, maybe I was actually taking much longer to get out than most people would. There were echoes of my professional experience saying, you know, you tell people you should do this, so you better do it.
Yeah, I had never heard the idea of plugging your gutters and filling them with water, which is a brilliant idea, of course. So thanks for that.
Yeah. No, well, so it also, you know what, the other thing it did, it made me realize, because I've mentioned that to more than one person now, and a couple people have said, gosh, why haven't I ever heard that?
Yeah.
And it made me realize, you know, having done it now for myself, even writing up a quick last minute things to do considerations
checklist
blog, yeah, checklist, because there are tons of checklists out there, but actually I took some pictures while I was doing it, and it made me think, you know, I should probably string this together, thread it together in something that's actually useful for the rest of for the rest of us, so that if somebody did have the time and the interest and the motivation to do something, you can. And actually, when I got back probably 2 weeks later, some of the gutters were still full of water.
Wow.
You know, and actually that, yeah. I found some large, probably 2 inches long, about a big around as a pencil, mm-hmm, some burned embers that had landed on the roof.
Oh, scary.
Yeah, that were
probably still
glowing when they landed.
You must have asphalt or metal on your roof,
yeah,
right?
Yep, the asphalt shingles.
So you're now one of the foremost authorities on climate, fire, ecology, human systems in California, nationally, in the world. But I mean, looking at your background, it sounds like there were multiple times in which you could have gone down or even thought about going down a different pathway.
True.
I mean, your parents were doctors and you were sort of thinking about that.
That's true. When I was growing up, my parents were both in medicine. My grandfather was a small town doctor. Hmm. A lot of my aunts and uncles were in medical fields, and I worked in a pharmacy, and you know, I sort of thought maybe I wanted to go that route, and yet after spending a couple of summers working in a hospital and specifically in the operating rooms,
yeah.
I realized I'm probably not cut out for this.
Gore or?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Having to clean up, you know, as working in the operating rooms, you get the short straw. You're the one cleaning up all the mess. And so you really see firsthand what goes down and, you know, carrying an amputated limb down to the lab. And you realize, when you see it up close, you think, maybe a lot of people who go in and become doctors actually don't go through that until it's too late.
They've spent $300,000 and they're fully
right,
committed.
Right, right. So anyway, I think I decided I like science, but this is probably not for me. And I have had a pretty convoluted path, actually. I tried to be a yuppie the first time through. So this is actually my second career. I went through my undergrad and kind of went through a business management, computer science, mm-hmm, econ, statistics type of undergrad, and tried to do that for a few years and just realized that was not, you know, wearing a dark gray suit and black wingtips in downtown LA wasn't me.
Were you doing like financial work, or what were you doing then in LA?
At the time, it was a wing of Arthur Anderson, one of the big, mm-hmm, accounting and audit firms. They had a wing, yeah, that broke off and became, it might have been called Accenture. I don't follow it, but they were computer systems and IT. It was called MIS back then, Management, mm-hmm, Information Systems.
Not Marine Isotope Stage.
No. You'd go into a big company or government agency and you'd help them design and create new computer systems.
So management consulting.
Basically management, wow, consulting with an IT emphasis. And so I did that for a few years. So I learned a lot about programming and a lot about business, and through my undergrad I had learned a lot about statistics and decision theory and optimization. Uh-huh. And but near the end of my undergrad, I had kind of started thinking, I wonder if I want to go into, you know, kind of biology and sort of complex systems in biology, but it was too late. So that when I had become disillusioned after a few years in this other career, I did a long, slow switch over to try to be a scientist. I thought maybe that's what I want to do. So I went back and got a kind of an interdisciplinary master's in environmental science.
Well, that was with Robert Kaufman, right?
Yeah. So actually, it was energy and environmental studies. Mm-hmm. Yep, at BU with Robert. Yeah.
And I guess I know him as almost having kind of like an econometrics approach to climate science topics.
Yeah, I don't remember at the time if he was so much into that. He was definitely into the energy and modeling, quantitative modeling world. And for me, I was getting a master's. It was a slow reformation of my thinking to, even though I knew I wanted to do something environmentally oriented, and I knew I probably wanted to go into academics. I didn't have the credentials, basically.
Okay.
So I thought, if I want to get a PhD in ecology or, you know, some natural science field, I coming from a business background, I felt like I needed to retool and have another degree to do that. So I learned a lot, and I got another degree, and then I worked for an environmental consulting firm for a little while there, and then just realized, yeah, I like being in academics. I really want to study something large scale. And so I decided to go back. Yeah, I was around 30 when I finally entered a PhD program.
And that would have been like mid-90s, more or less, or mid to late 90s?
Yeah, early 90s. Yep. Probably, let's see, 91, 93 was master's, so it was 93. 93 to 99 was PhD at UC Santa Barbara in geography, in a biogeography lab. I ended up focusing on fire just out of sheer luck. For one of my summer gigs, I didn't have a project to focus on, and the Los Padres National Forest, the ecologist there, said, "Hey, we've got these fire maps. We've got, you know, almost 100 years worth of fires mapped, and we tried to digitize them once. It worked pretty well, but we really think we got something here. What do you think?" And there was a little bit of money, and I ended up spending a lot of time digitizing these maps, and I was an early adopter, early user of GIS, of geographic information systems, back when literally you would hit, you know, display map, and you'd go get lunch. It would take forever.
This is the early days of ArcInfo or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I spent the summer digitizing these, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of polygons of past fires, and I realized that this is probably a pretty unique data set, and it fit my need for something that was really broad spatial scale, and also had a fairly long temporal scale. At least,
just for a scale, what is the size of that Los Padres National Forest?
It's a couple million acres, mostly chaparral shrublands. Mm-hmm. Even though it's a national forest, it's vastly dominated by shrublands, and there's some mixed evergreen forest up further north. But I ended up with these fire maps, mapped fire perimeters, which is one of the earlier mapped fire histories, fire atlases, and ended up, you know, tackling that, using that as the basis for a lot of the questions I asked in my dissertation.
What do you get from that kind of analysis as opposed to looking at fire scars and tree rings? I mean, I guess you get the spatial extent, but maybe not the exact, like, I guess you would get annual resolution, but you wouldn't get the longer time horizon, I suppose.
That's true. You don't get the longer time horizon. But 100 years of fire history in an area like this, which contains a lot of fires, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fires, it does provide some, you know, through some space for time substitution, you can ask some good questions. What you don't get, especially from the older maps, which are useful now, we're getting products now where you get differences in fire severity within the fire perimeters. And that's actually really interesting data that we have now to work with, because not every fire, you know, you might have the footprint of a fire, but not every fire burned every ounce of biomass within that footprint, right? There's variation that might be due to topography, it might be due to winds, it might be due to the vegetation type or the time since the last fire, the direction the fire was progressing, and so on. So one of the things we don't have from the older fire maps is any nuance as to what was burned less severely, or even islands of unburned vegetation.
It seems like there's an overall consensus that there are two main fire regimes, one in which you're limited by fuels and one in which you're limited by climate variability. Is that, when you were getting into it at the time doing this digitization, was that your sense of where the field was? And has it been changing at all since then?
I think that's kind of emerged. What was a little more of a focus, a couple of decades ago, was more of a fuels versus weather argument that, we may be seeing these large and intense fires in different ecosystems, and to what degree were they caused by, say, fire suppression, that we had put out a lot of the fires that naturally would have occurred in this area. For example, in forests, the argument is that through fire suppression, you end up with a lot of denser forests. In particular, you might end up with a lot of smaller, younger trees infilling and creating ladder fuels that connect the what would normally be a surface fire maybe up into the crowns of the overstory. And in other ecosystems, in shrublands, there was a raging debate about kind of a similar story, that maybe lots of smaller fires. In shrublands, you don't have an understory and an overstory, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. When shrublands burn, it's a crown fire. And some forests, many of our forests burn naturally in crown fires too. But in shrublands, it's pretty much always a crown fire. And the argument there was that putting out a lot of the smaller fires that would have created kind of a patchy age class mosaic, by putting a lot of those out, we maybe have broken this internal constraint that if a fire did occur, it wouldn't have to burn very far before it hit a relatively young age patch where it would naturally go out.
Just for lack of fuels.
Yeah. Right. So it was sort of, there were these arguments about the degree to which age mattered and an age class or an age patch mosaic should be a management goal, that we should try to recreate that on the landscape. And there were some very high profile paper in 1983 in Science that really had set the tone for that looked at patchy landscape structure, mostly due to fire down in Baja California, and comparing that to the north of the border in the United States, in Southern California, and kind of making the case that down there was a natural regime and we had broken the system, and up here we put out all the fires under mild conditions, which would normally be self-limiting. And when we do get fires under these bad Santa Ana wind conditions, they're burning through an unnatural, kind of homogenized, old, fuel-rich landscape. And so there were parallels in this fire versus weather debate in forests and in shrublands. And I ended up trying to answer some of those questions in shrublands with these maps that I had digitized and analyzed for my dissertation.
Did you find that there were any major flaws in that narrative from that early 80s science paper then?
That was one of my early realizations of how intense scientific debates can be amongst people. Yeah, because what I found, at least looking at the Los Padres National Forest maps, I found actually that age of a given patch didn't matter that much. There are ways to quantify hazard, and it's the same general methodology that they use in some forests. It's also used in kind of failure analysis. You can look at the hazard rate or survival analysis. You can look at the hazard of burning given that something has survived up to a certain time. And I applied that to these age classes. And what you saw is that actually there were very few parts of this particular landscape that seemed to be constrained by the time since the last fire. That instead, when fires did happen and when most of the area was being burned, it was probably burning under these extreme weather conditions that if you talk to firefighters, they'll tell you that under the right conditions, fires will burn through young, medium, and old age classes. Not with the same intensities, but they will still burn. And that, this age-dependent idea, the argument, probably wasn't universal anyway. It wasn't something that could be applied across chaparral shrublands as widely as it had been. You see a little more nuance now in the discussions about it. It's not so black and white.
Good.
Yeah, it is. It is good. There were some follow-on work from that where we were actually able to map some of the wind patterns, to actually map Santa Ana wind corridors, so you could find out when Santa Ana's were happening, what parts of the landscape seemed to be hit the most severely and what parts seemed to be kind of sheltered from them. And not surprisingly, the largest fires actually are preferentially found in these wind corridors. So there is a very strong weather component to most of the story now, especially with the abundance of human ignitions.
Now, part of your job is working in extension, which I don't know if it's a uniquely U.S. thing or if it has deep roots in other parts of the world, but part of that is working with the people of the state, essentially, and trying to address their needs, their concerns. And part of that for you would be trying to understand with them their fire risks. But I'm guessing that also you must be heavily involved in discussions with, for example, regulators and the insurance industry. And when you find things like this tight coupling of wind patterns with fire risk, the insurers must see that and think, okay, well, this is where we need to triple our insurance rates. Is it that linear of an interaction, or is it much more diluted through the political process?
You know, I need to understand more about the whole insurance industry. My interactions with them, because I did many years ago try to approach them and with some of these findings and say, look, wouldn't it make sense if we had better maps of some of these patterns, and not just in not just course spatially and temporally, but also across other parts of the landscape? Because we know there are other fire weather patterns. There's Diablos up there where you are. There's there's sundowner winds in Santa Barbara, and these are all somewhat similar in the fact that they're caused by pressure gradients, but they all have their own timing and their own unique manifestation, you know, spatially and temporally. What I found was that I think most of the insurers, they make their living by pooling their risk across many of their holdings. So, you know, if they're going to write policies in a given region, they might use some of the risk rating products that are out there. There are services that actually purport to map hazard and risk well, and they're actually they're somewhat crude instruments. They're missing most of the things we're talking about. These wind patterns and some of the fire probability modeling that we've also done it doesn't make its way into most of these risk rating products. So they'll use those, which are kind of a blunt instrument. And then if they're going to write a policy in an area, I think what they do is they'll increase the policy pricing a little bit in some areas, but they'll also increase it maybe in the flats where they know they're not going to have a lot of fire losses, to sort of pool, you know. And I don't think they're not set up to work at parcel by parcel level, which is, it's too bad.
I mean, they should be though, right?
Well, there's lots of carrots and sticks. A lot of people think the insurance industry could really help overhaul the fire problem, although that's a misnomer. But, you know, there could be a lot of good done if the insurance companies were more adept at working at very fine scales, because they could then, you know, they could map hazard better. And you could also then mitigate vulnerabilities and actually offer some rewards to homeowners for doing that.
For example, in these areas where you've had the fires followed by the debris flows, I'm pretty sure that your community could have provided information that the hazards here are actually vastly higher. Insurers could have had triple the rates or forced self-insurance, or if they were going to insure, have mandated the kind of mitigation strategies and building codes or construction or inspections that might have mitigated some of the damage. I mean, do you see that as one way this could go, or is that too draconian or unfair to the people living there?
I don't know that anybody has a good measure or a good model for the debris flow. I think we know it's always possible, but the potential for a heavy rainfall on a freshly burned slope that's going to trigger a debris flow. I don't know that we have A, good models for that, or B, good mitigation measures. I know that, you know, there's lots you can do to make your home less vulnerable to ignition, for example. You know, but I don't know if you were going to go out and say, okay, I live in an area that at least it's potentially prone to a debris flow. You know, would you? I don't know if you could build a.
What would you do?
Build a wall around it.
You could build your house on, you know, concrete pillars 10 meters off the ground. It's probably not too practical.
Not too practical. No, but I mean, you see that along the coastlines. You know, we're talking about...
True.
We're talking about...
But those are people with deep pockets.
Right.
But the In California, anyway.
But the idea of passive survivability, you know, that idea of passive survivability, if you can design into the neighborhood the what's needed to actually make it through what the landscape is potentially going to throw at you, that...
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I really do think that with climate change, we're going to have to start thinking more like that.
Well, I think that's been one of your, you know, one of your main themes. You sort of hinted at this a minute ago when you mentioned the fire problem not really being a problem. I feel like one idea you've been developing in your publications and in your public outreach is that we really have to be viewing fire as part of the system in which we're living, and that climate change is going to heighten the intensity of that interaction, but that we still need to view it as being part of our lives, not something that needs to be constantly like fought against or excluded.
Right, and I think there's a number of us that are starting to use that. You see living with fire, you see coexisting with fire, et cetera, et cetera. As a scientist, you can spend a lot of time trying to put new bricks in the wall of science and advance our thinking. And then at some point you realize, I really want this to count too. I want this to change the way, change the way we're living. Thankfully for me, part of my mission, part of my job title is actually to try to get that, to get the word out there, to actually find ways, find problems and stakeholders that are open to change, try to actually impact decision making. So I have gravitated towards that, towards trying to solve applied problems that bring people into the mix. Because I don't think it does. I mean, we can all try to write big papers that get cited a lot, but at the end of the day, you really want them to count. You know, you want your kids to live in a happier, safer place.
And policy folks do not really read papers in Nature or
no.
I think
well, so that
other journals
they do not. Although, you know, it's funny if you name a paper appropriately, like the one you're thinking of, you know, learning to coexist with wildfire. It has a certain ring to it that I was surprised at how many people had actually seen or heard it. Mm-hmm. You know, if I travel to DC or something like that and talk with a policymaker, I think the other prong of my extension program, that the other hat that I've tried to wear, you mentioned trying to interact with state agencies, and I've definitely reached out and tried to get some of the hazard mapping techniques and some of the climate change models that we've applied to fire. Try to get those in use so that they're actually useful. You know, for example, some of these wind and hazard mapping techniques that we're talking about there, you know, we're pushing those forward, and actually those are going to update the future fire hazard severity zone maps in the state with guide building codes.
That's a huge impact. Right? If you can nudge building codes. Yeah,
exactly. They're all little nudges, but these are ways that you actually get the science out into some real, some real application, or the fire probability modeling that we've done with climate change. Trying to get that out. It's now being used for emissions reductions. Trying to target where you might want to do fuels treatments to achieve avoided emissions. It's a lot of modeling, but you know, the idea that we could locate fuels treatments in optimal places and optimal ways in a climate change context to actually avoid future emissions using the models and getting them out there into the agencies so that they can make better decisions. But that's one way I think my extension program has tried to be effective. But then the other is by trying to change public perception, as squishy as that is, trying to actually improve the public understanding of what the wildfire problem is, you know, quote, because a lot of people talk about it as being, you know, there being some monolithic wildfire problem, that there's one, you know, we've got a lot of fuels build up on the landscape and we got to clear it out. And that,
but really, it's a million local problems.
Exactly.
It seems like
it's like so many other things that when you drill down into it, each ecosystem has its own unique, you know, fire history and fire regime that the species within it are adapted to varying degrees. Some are fire sensitive, right? Yeah. And it's not just fire, black and white. It's the timing and the size and the intensity. And they're all, you know, lots of these different systems have different regimes, and we've done different things to them. And so that's all in the natural system side, more or less. And then we've built how and where we've built our communities and our is very different in different places. So it's a really messy problem that, like you said, I've tried to come at it as learning to coexist with this, just like we deal with other natural hazards, whether they be floods mm-hmm. or earthquakes or tornadoes. Hurricanes, waves, storm surges. How do we build on the landscape so that we are safer for when these inevitable events occur?
So, I mean, one big narrative that's been going on for a long time in the Western U.S. is the increased rate of building in the urban wildland interface. And people are not building in the foothills of the Sierras all over the place. And, you know, my mom lived in Glorieta, New Mexico, and actually had a really, really hard time getting fire insurance when she was trying to sell her house. They wouldn't write it because it was too far from a fire hydrant, essentially. Hmm. But, I mean, the issues that people are facing here are that the building permits are controlled at a local level, primarily, with building permits and regulations, in which you can imagine that there are financial or political or interpersonal relationships at work that might make it difficult to take the advice from a pointy-headed intellectual from UC Santa Barbara and, you know, say we need to be revising our permitting process for this zone. So if you, not that you are or that you should, but if you were to go to enter into this dialogue, what do you think would be a more effective versus a less effective wedge with which to say maybe we should be backing off building in these areas or at least building in a particular way in these areas?
Well, first of all, the pointy head part, I usually sand the point down a little bit. I try to blunt it a little.
It always grows back there. That's the problem.
Yeah, but you're right. You can't be too academic about this because these are real, you know, these are real dollars and cents issues, and there's political aspects to them that don't really have anything to do with science, right? They're
yeah.
politics and power. And mm-hmm. one of the key wedges, levers, well, there's a couple. One is that I think if people understood more about how much taxpayers end up kind of holding the bag for a lot of local
right.
decisions that affect much, much wider expanses of people and resources, I mm-hmm. think if we could somehow quantify that, if we could make the link between a local development decision and, you know, and FEMA disaster funding and, you know, federal funds that come down to the states that actually impact development patterns, and there's no stipulation on them being actually cited in the least hazardous parts of the landscape, for example, you know, there's all these links that aren't made that I think if they were made would actually maybe change the way we do things. The other lever or the other message that I think it would be really useful to get across that might actually raise some eyebrows is everybody's worried about fire. And to the degree that people are worried about fire and climate change and climate change making it worse, you know, some of the recent findings that mm-hmm. we've had out of my lab and out of some other groups are that actually, when you look back at land development patterns and climate influences over broad scales, you actually find that the climate signal is important. And you know, it's partly because climate affects the productivity and fuel accumulation and whether a system is fuel limited or not on average. And then the other part of the climate story is A system can be flammability limited. There can be a lot of fuel, but actually no window in time in which there's a fire season, right? It's not, the fuel that's there isn't flammable mm-hmm. that often. So, you know, whether something, whether a system's more fuel limited or more flammability limited, both of those are climate stories. And we have good data to try to understand that and project that into the future. But what we're learning now is that actually land development, the human footprint on the landscape is in many areas as influential on fire frequencies, on fire probabilities, as the climate signal.
I mean, do you mean the level of fragmentation in a subdivision, or do you mean just the densification or the fragmentation of forests? What kind of changes are we talking about here?
Probably all of those. So, okay. So there's something that has been called the Pyrrhic transition.
And ooh, very yeah, good.
you know, depending on how you interpret it, the general story is that, you know, there's some background level of fire on many landscapes. Many terrestrial ecosystems have fire on them.
Sure.
And then as humans occupy and utilize and develop landscapes, the sources of ignitions go up, right? We burn the landscape more. We use fire as a tool in general. Mm-hmm. And there might be more and more fire up to some peak. And then it starts to drop off as we've continued to develop these landscapes. We've fragmented them more and more and more. We've got more paved surface or more in agricultural use.
Right. So you don't have fires in down in like the middle of Los Angeles.
You generally don't. You generally don't. And it's culturally, there's a cultural shift too. You don't have people throwing flaming, you know, things out of their windows as often. And you have organized fire suppression. You have fire departments. You know, so that there's this general hump-shaped response, we think, in many landscapes of fire activity, fire frequencies to...
Like some kind of like a Gaussian curve through time in this? Or
yeah, yeah.
No, okay.
Yeah, not unlike the demographic transition of education and birth rates and things like that.
Yeah,
that
okay.
Basically, uh-huh, sure. You know, as you develop a landscape, many landscapes might go through this relatively predictable set of steps. And it turns out that we've been able to actually kind of map that out. And indeed, it turns out that even in California, you can capture this signal that there are places that are less dense, places that are more dense. And there's a signal that there's almost a functional response of fire to human development that is, in terms of how important it is in the models, it rivals the climate signal in many cases. So what that tells us, though, is that, you know, even if we really want to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and we want to do something about climate change, we actually have a lever through land use planning.
Okay, so what that immediately suggests then is that if you have a global map of this, you know the relative development levels from, I don't know, whatever, city lights, you know the climate, you know the vegetation status, you must be able to identify parts of the world where the fire frequency should be higher for a given combination, but is actually lower, which would infer what kind of management activities there might be effective.
Maybe. I don't know that it's been done globally. I don't know that it's been globally, but yeah, that's the general idea. You could look for, you know, more than a fire deficit, for example. Or you could maybe as you were looking at build out on a given landscape, you could use this knowledge of where you are on that response curve to decide, hey, you know, I think actually this landscape isn't at this point yet. Let's develop in this way rather than this way so that And I think, so that's one lever that is obvious, that land use planning actually, it not only dictates how much exposure we put people in, right? It's not just that we're building homes on fire-prone landscapes and it's the exposure part. It actually feeds back to alter the fire probabilities themselves. We can actually have an effect on these systems by where and how we build. It doesn't always mean building fewer homes, because land use planning and private property rights are, you know, those are hot button issues. You know, but I think the story isn't that we need to build fewer homes. We just need to build smarter. We need to, as we build out into these probably increasingly fire prone landscapes, we need to, A, you know, at a broad spatial scale, concentrate the development in the lower hazard parts, not fewer, but right. just concentrating mm-hmm. it in the lower hazard parts of the landscape. And then as we build these developments, you know, the spatial layout of the design of the neighborhood and the construction codes and the building materials, all of those can come together to build much, much safer, more fire resistant communities, so that, you know, maybe our grandkids' kids will be living in the kind of communities where when fires come through, you just shut the windows.
I mean, I guess a large part of this must be highly cultural, though. I spent grad school in Montana, and what people want there is a few acres and a log cabin. But one alternative would be to have quite a lot of open space and then relatively densified and fire-resistant developments in a few less fire-prone areas. But that's not what I see happening in these areas. Do you see signs that particular areas, climates, municipalities, or demographics are actually moving in that direction or in a similarly more resilient direction?
In California, we have some building codes and land use planning guidelines that are moving in the right direction. Actually, California is kind of the fire hazard severity zone maps, and the fact that building codes are tied to them is kind of unique. And improving those and getting more of what we know about how and why different communities have burned in the past and how to do it better in the future. All of those things are slowly making their way, hopefully, into law and into best practices guidelines. But there's always going to be people that want to live, that don't want to live in an easily defendable, fire resistant, high density, community.
For sure.
And that's not to say that they shouldn't be able to. I just think that if people knew more about why structures burn. So, for example, we've learned that most structures burn from embers flying and getting on a wood. The worst, the most vulnerable component of a home is to have a wood shake shingle roof.
The worst. Oh my gosh.
The absolute worst. Yeah. Right. And that's pretty common knowledge, thankfully, now. But beyond that.
But still being done.
Yeah, here and there. Yeah, you do see it. You do see it. But after that, though, still most homes burn from embers getting into vents, into attic and crawl space vents, and getting inside the building envelope. And most homes burning from the inside out after
I didn't know that.
Yeah, after people have been evacuated, most homes burning it from the inside out, or getting in the gutters and starting the leaves on fire, or getting under the deck and starting some duff.
Yeah.
So most homes burn from embers that are coming from possibly relatively far away from the home. So we hear a lot about defensible space around a structure, around the individual mm-hmm. home. But I think that those isolated Montana wood cabins, wood siding isn't necessarily, I don't think, a universally bad thing to have from a vulnerability point of view. If your structure is built to be protected from ember intrusion and you don't have a wood shake roof and you've kind of been good about the maintenance around the structure, a log mm-hmm. cabin, a well-built log cabin might be a pretty...
Just fine.
Yeah, it might be.
The ideas you're talking about, that these kind of building codes and land development are important, isn't really surprising to me. But what is surprising is that they could be as important or more important than the climate or climate change. Is that a message that is on the... like in the words of my Montana advisor, on the lunatic fringe of climate science? Or is this an entrenched idea in the community? And where do you see this transition being in terms of the uptake of this idea in not just California, but broader U.S. policy?
Good question. I hope it's not on the lunatic fringe. You put me right in the middle of that. So, it's not new that we should probably be paying more attention to where and how we build our communities.
That
idea isn't really new. What is relatively new, really just in the last few years, is that we have good evidence now that where and how we build our communities feeds back to affect the fire regimes themselves. Mm-hmm. That is new knowledge, and trying to get the message out that that's a lever we can pull to make ourselves safer through how we develop in the future. That's relatively new, and I think it's a pretty key important message to to get out there, because I think everybody throws up their hands and says land use planning is all local. And, you know, it really, if it is, it shouldn't be. And it's an underappreciated tool in the toolkit that we have to actually live in a more resilient future in the face of fire. So I think it's a relatively new message that is slowly percolating. It's making its way out there, but I don't think it's generally understood yet. But there's a lot of politics in land use planning. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Even with a finding like that, there's so much politics in land use planning that even with an event like the Santa Rosa, you know, the Tubbs fire up there with you guys, it was such a devastating event. You know, you'd think that now the time is right, you know, for some stronger land use planning, that we really need to have not a totally top down version of land use planning, but there has to be a lot more best practices, a lot more guidance and oversight in the general planning and you know, the long term planning process and in the daily process of developing individual subdivisions. All that could be done much better.
Now, you've just been telling me how climate might be a secondary concern for fires in the future, but when I think about kind of the worst case scenario from our conversation and just thinking about fires, it seems like the worst thing would be if you had increased climate variability, such that you had a sequence of warm, wet years building up massive fuel loads, followed by a few years of extreme drought and high heat, which is at least a possibility with climate change. Is that a leading threat from climate change in the work you've done, or do you see the biggest threats that do come from climate change being in other ways?
No, you're right. And I guess I would clarify just before going into that, I think that the human development part of the story, I don't think it's more important than climate change, but I think I think that the fact that we've now found and been able to quantify the fact that in some parts of the landscape, it's as strong as the climate signal. It just gives I think it's an underappreciated part of the story that we can now hopefully make some better decisions with. But I think you're right. The climate part is huge. Maybe to step back a little bit, the way we in the past had been looking at modeling climate change and fire together, several of us, at least using the statistical approaches we have now, we were using a lot of the climate norms for this. So you might use, you know, temperature in the warmest month or precipitation in the driest month, or, you know, you'd use these climate norms that you had found useful for predicting fire. And then that kind of transitioned to a little more useful, more process-oriented metrics of AET, actual evapotranspiration, and climatic water deficit. So these are sort of plant-centric ways of bringing different climate variables together, and different climate variables actually predict AET, which is just plant productivity, and climatic water deficit, which is really a good surrogate for the length and severity of the fire season.
If that number is huge, if it's like, you know, whatever, 10 meters a year, serious problems.
Yeah, exactly. The bigger it is, the more the plants are shut down, their stomata are tightly closed, and the more they're putting up with some pretty severe water stress. So that's actually, it turns out that AET, the climate variables that go into AET, the different ones in different areas, turn out to be a good metric of that fuel availability side of the fire story. And then variables that go into climatic water deficit, which is a good surrogate for how hot, dry, and long a fire season might be. And those are different in different areas too. We've now gravitated towards using climate variables that actually represent those two axes, because they're good.
Okay.
You know, they're more mechanistic. They get closer to what we want to be modeling. And those are also based on long-term climate norms in general, because in the past, we didn't have that interannual variability coming out of the GCMs that we trusted very much. So your point about, you know, interannual variability, a few really wet years followed by a string of really hot, dry years, that's, from a fire perspective, that sets things up for a really potentially explosive fire season, right? But in the past, we haven't tended to use or rely on those variables too much for our future projections, because I don't think we trusted the GCMs to actually produce those.
They're just not robust for that.
Because that's really getting this type of year in sequence with this type of year right. Right?
That would be probably incredibly model dependent, though, still, I would think.
I think they're getting better and better, and I think there is an argument for now trying to explicitly include that interannual variability into the models, because we haven't been doing that very well in general. So the next generation of fire projections will probably, to the degree that the GCMs are doing a good job of it, we'll start folding that in.
So, we've covered a lot about fire, but maybe come back a little bit to your own career. You spent a lot of time in California, both in your bachelor's, your PhD. Your initial professional career was at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and then you're still, I think, officially employed by UC Berkeley. You were up at UC Berkeley when I first arrived here in 2010. In fact, you were the first person who took me to the Cheese Award Collective. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That's a great place.
At the time, I kind of remember us having these conversations about your house over in Mill Valley, and you were feeling kind of keen to move down to Santa Barbara. You did make that move.
I did.
Can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to do that and how it's been going for you down in Santa Barbara?
Yeah, so actually, technically, I am no longer associated with Berkeley. I'm still a UC employee, but...
Oh, okay, right. You're with the president's office. Sorry, right.
Well,
is that right?
What happened? I went on sabbatical in 2010 to 2011, and my wife and I, we were trying to figure out where do we want to go and what do we want to do. Do we want to go to Australia? I have a lot of good colleagues there. And anyway, for any number of reasons, we ended up back in Santa Barbara, and we realized professionally, because I still have a lot of colleagues here. I wrote a bunch of proposals during that window of time, and a lot of them got funded, and I ran into lots of old colleagues that had shared interests, and personally, we still have a lot of friends in this part of the world that mm-hmm. this still felt like home, and a lot of my experience in research was more Southern California focused than it is in many of the forested environments further north. So there were a lot of there were a lot of pulls for this part of the world feeling professionally and personally like home. And then after being here a couple of years, ANR, Ag and Natural Resources Division, they have actually started trying to place cooperative extension specialists. So I'm a statewide fire specialist. They've started trying to place specialists at some of the non-ANR campuses to branch out and make connections to these other, these other parts of the UC and these other parts of the state that were very relevant. I'm actually housed now officially on the UCSB campus, even though I'm still part of the UC ANR wing. Yeah, so I still have a research program and an extension program where I'm, trying to connect research to policymakers and a lot of the agency folks. But I moved back down here. It just felt like home, and then all of a sudden we were going to have a family. Whoa! So lots of reasons that this ended up being a good fit. Yeah. Now I'm an adjunct prof in the Bren School at the UCSB campus, and I'm basically still doing much the same work, but just a different office. I'm far from the cheese board, though. I'll tell you that.
We're now both middle-aged parents, which I find to be one of the most exhausting things I can possibly imagine.
I don't know. Do you feel like, though, if you had done it, 15 years ago when everybody else, a lot of your colleagues maybe were doing it, or at least mine, I was pretty harebrained running scattered. I was a scatterbrained academic. I'm still a scatterbrained academic, but I sort of feel like I'm a little more centered, and so that I can actually.
Yeah, for sure.
You can contribute a little bit in a different way, I think. Not without as much energy, though. Yeah, you're more sleep deprived and you're more tired. But
I was out in a bike ride with a group, and this older guy told me about having kids. He's like, every day is like a year, and every year is like a day.
That's interesting. Yeah. Time has taken on a completely new meaning.
Yeah.
For sure. You have this new yardstick. It really focuses a lot of things. In different
How old's your kid?
She is six.
Oh, yeah. Same here. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, kindergarten.
It's an amazing age, yeah. Wow, yeah. Today was a crazy sock day, and my son wore socks. He's like an alligator eating his legs. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, today was pajama day. Yep,
same. Oh, there you go. Yeah. Well, Max, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad we finally
got a chance to talk. It was great.
Me too, Mike. It was fun.
And wishing you staying safe with the possibility of these new mudslides.
Yep.
No, although I know you're out of the danger zone, but still.
This year we are, yeah. But thank you. Thank you. It was great to loop back and connect again. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, you too. Take care.
And that was my interview with Max Moritz. Max, hey, thank you for sticking with me these past months of trying to schedule the interview and for the time during the talk. Hope you all continue to stay safe with the fires and mudslides that are all bad work down there in your part of California. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests, not necessarily those of Nature or our parent company, Springer Nature. You can subscribe to Forecast, through your favorite podcasting application. You'll get notifications right away. And would continue to love to get more reviews on iTunes if you feel like you're up to it. That would be terrific. Helps to make the show more visible to other science nerds like yourself. You can reach me. I'm at MWClimateSci on Twitter or forecastpod@gmail.com. And I continue to get great suggestions for guests to get on the show. And speaking of which, I'm going to be talking with Michael Greenstone, the famous economist from the University of Chicago, coming up. I don't think I'm going to talk to him like kind of middle of the night in London in our recording studio. So at least the audio will be good. And then coming up, Maisa Rojas, whose name I'm sure I am mispronouncing, and then hopefully launching into a lot more discussions with scientists from less represented countries, at least less represented here on Forecast and really to a large extent in the pages of Nature. So I'll talk to you soon with Michael Greenstone.